What is happening? How are you? It's Yogi Roth, and this is Life Without Limits podcast. This has been so much fun, to be quite honest with you. We had so many incredible guests, started with my mom, brought on Wordsmith, and today's guest I am jacked for. I mean, this is a guy who's influenced my life in ways I never dreamt of. His name is Kevin Carroll. He's an agent of change. He's a speaker. He's an author. And you are going to dig his story. He's going to get you. I hope you didn't work out yet or do anything energetically, because you are going to be charging off of this. So let's bring in KC right now. Kevin, you there, man?
Absolutely. What's happening? What's happening, yo? You good?
Oh, so good. I was just saying in the intro how jacked I am to have you on. And, you know, I got to be honest, man, this podcast thing, it was inspired largely because of you. And I want to make sure the listeners know a little bit about our background. But basically, every time I talk to Kevin, outside of this conversation, I will have taken notes. I mean, literally, KC, when we talk, I have to come home and open up a Word document just to write. And thankfully, this one's going to be recorded, so I'll be able to take notes later, man.
Yeah, that's the luxury of you recording this one. This is the first time you've ever recorded it and not had to write it down and capture it in live and in person kind of a deal, or over the phone or whatever. I know you always set up your little cubby or workspace wherever you might be, but especially like you said, when you're going to talk to me, you're always like, make sure I got my stuff together before we really had this convo. So yeah, so I love the fact that you're recording it. So you've raised your game, man. It's the 2.0 version of you.
There we go. Well, there's so much to talk to you about, and we could literally have, and we could talk for hours, and you're going to be a guest on this hopefully many times. But I want to dive in today with you with elements of your story. I mean, you've always said that a ball saved your life, and there's so many people listening to this that that has happened, and some of them have recognized it, and some of them maybe didn't. And they'll go back as they listen to this conversation and say, wow, yeah, you know, my life was transformed by a ball. But for you specifically, when you say that, you say it with such reverence. You've said it in your book, The Rules of the Red Rubber Ball. You've said it in probably every presentation you've ever given. But how did that happen when you go way back and look at where this thing started for you in Philly?
I think it's interesting. I just got done watching this really fantastic documentary called Bounce, How the Ball Taught the World How to Play. Mm-hmm. And it's a must-see for anyone, obviously, who's around sports or play, but even just for anyone who's chasing a dream or a passion or something that inspires them. It really does talk about this chase, right, this pursuit of something, and, you know, how we as human beings really are drawn to movement. We're drawn to things that move, and a ball is the most elementary icon or item that demonstrates movement to us. And so I always talk about it with a level of reverence and respect, because, you know, the ball represents belonging and connecting and community to me, and it was a social catalyst for me, and play really was that. And so I look at the ball, and I do say that with sincerity, that it saved my life. And if it wasn't for, you know, a local playground and the kids that played at that playground and them inviting me to play, you know, games with them, all involving a ball of some sort, and I don't know what would have happened to me because of the circumstances and the challenges I and my brothers were facing as children. And so I do believe that it saved me. I do believe that it gave me exactly what I needed at that point in my life, which was connection and belonging and community and without parents. And it really allowed me to rise above my circumstances. I just firmly believe that. I will defend it to my last breath that it was my catalyst, and it opened doors for all kinds of other things to happen. And I just really love telling people that everyone should have something they're chasing, something they're pursuing. For, you know, some of us, it literally is sports and play and a ball. And for others, it's just whatever lights you up, what sparks you each morning to get up and go after it and pursue it. And I think that's what we need as human beings, is to have something to pursue, to have something that sparks us, that lights up our soul every single day. And so the ball is that for me, but it could be math, science, music, dance, writing, whatever it might be, but you need to have something that's your red rubber ball, is what I say to people. So, yeah, man, I'll get on my bully pulpit, brother. I'll get on my soapbox about it for sure. That's not a problem.
So what were your circumstances for those that do not know your story?
Both my parents. I mean, I speak of it in it seems kind of nonchalant ways, but just for people to understand that, you know, I've evolved a lot emotionally and, you know, my intellect around my emotions. So I can talk about it with a lot of calm in my voice, but just to understand how much upheaval and uncertainty and dysfunction we were dealing with as children, because both my parents were addicts and made a lot of really, really bad decisions that affected three little boys because of their addiction. And my father left when I was three and I never saw my dad again. And my mom left us when I was six. My older brother was eight and my little brother was three. And she left us in a trailer 200 miles away from Philadelphia, down in Virginia. And we weren't in school. We weren't sure when she was coming back. And fortunately, my grandparents taught us their phone number. And so I thought it was important for us to get back to somewhere we could be safe. And so I told my brothers, we need to find somebody to call my mom and pop up. That's what we called my grandparents. And so we sought out some help and found another trailer and a stranger in there willing to dial the number. And we talked to my grandfather, and he makes arrangements with the stranger to take us to a local bus station there in Bowling Green, Virginia, and find the bus driver, because we don't have money or parents, and to see if that bus driver would agree to take three boys, three strangers, back to Philadelphia with the promise that their grandparents will be waiting at the bus station and they'll pay you back. And so, I can talk about it in this way, but just imagine, you know, the upheaval and fear we had as children, that you're riding 200 miles by yourself with a bus driver who doesn't know you, but's going to watch over you. And it's the 1960s, the civil rights movement is going on. Three African-American boys are in the South in these turbulent and tumultuous times. And it's dangerous for us. And this bus driver who agrees to take us back is white. So he didn't have to say yes. He showed a level of courage to say, yeah, I'll watch over these kids and get them back. Then the stranger, the woman, agrees to call my grandfather. So look at all these things that have to happen for us to be safe again. And mix in there that my mom doesn't check for another 2 weeks on us. So we could have been, who knows what might have happened to us if we had stayed. But those great circumstances, serendipity, whatever you want to call it, played out. And, you know, land back with my grandparents and happens to be this playground in their neighborhood that the energy epicenter, and that's the place that saved me. It was my first sanctuary, my first place where I felt calm and comfortable, and I started to get my swagger back, if you will, my confidence back, and actually maybe even just to grow confident. And that's really how it all kind of played out. And, you know, then things just started to come together for me because of the ball and my love of reading and, you know, this community of people who believed that I could be more than what my circumstances might be dictating for me.
What kind of kid were you? You know, we both work a lot with
curious, dude. I was curious. I was a curious kid, man. I was maybe people would have called me nosy back in the day. I don't know. I was into everything. I was just trying to. I was a seeker, I think, is a good way to call what I was as a kid. I was seeking out. I didn't have parents, right? So I had to find nuggets of wisdom and insight and enlightenment from anything and anyone. So I was really always seeking and very, very curious kid, really curious kid.
Did you know any different? Like, it would have been very easy if you said angry right there instead of curious.
Oh, absolutely.
How did you process that?
Absolutely. I, you know, it's interesting, Yogi. I think there were times I might have had moments where I was angry or why me a little bit, but I don't know. I think because there was always this wonderful distraction of play and sports and running and movement that I never stayed in that space very long. And yeah, there were those moments where you would pause and go, wow, you know, you'd see someone going away with their parents or whatever, but I just didn't want to dwell on that. I think I didn't have the words, but I didn't want to be a victim. I just didn't want to be that. And maybe it was people who were, I would overhear them saying, oh, those poor kids, oh, that poor boy, oh, that's so sad. Or hearing social workers basically write us off when they were talking to my grandparents, don't expect much. That I got a chip on my shoulders, that I basically, you know, had this I'll show you attitude. You don't know me. I'll show you. You watch. And I think that was a big part of it. So I think I channeled what could have potentially been detrimental, that anger, which anyone would have expected from me. And I just redirected it into I'm going to show you, as I would say as a kid, right? I'm going to show you. You watch. And I think that served me well. And all three of us did fine. You know, my older brother's retired Navy, 22 years, and he works in nursing down in Alabama. My younger brother, Kyle, is an IT specialist in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. But my journey took a very different path than my brother's. And you know, maybe I could be an auntie or an uncle or somebody in there that I got a little bit of, or my grandfather or grandmother. I think I'm a hodgepodge of all their attitudes and personalities that fed into something that I already had in me, right? That I was going to rise above it, right? That I was going to find a way to succeed in spite of the circumstances.
Did you reconnect with your folks? And if so, what's that like now?
So it's interesting. My father, no, like never, he never made any attempt to connect with us. I saw him in passing one day on the street in the neighborhood, but he didn't even recognize me. And I do remember having a brief conversation with him, like, do you know who I am? And him looking me up and down, and then his first words were, like, he was dissing me. He basically said, wow, you didn't grow very big at all. You look just like your mom.
Oh.
And I just looked at him, and I said, okay, and I walked away. And then my mom, and then I never connected, and I think I was 18 then, so it had already been 12 years, and I never reconnected with him at all. And then my mom, I always felt that, a need to try to create a reconnection and a relationship with her. But it never really worked out because it was just really hard. Her addiction, you know, ruled her life. But I also think that my mom, you know, struggled with shame, right? That she had, you know, made those decisions and her parents ended up raising us. And she just dealt with a lot of shame. She didn't show for either of her parents' funerals because she was in town and called but wouldn't come because she thought people would judge her. And her sisters, she had two sisters who tried to convince her to come around, but she wouldn't. And then I saw my mom maybe a handful of times up until I was 30. And then her sister, my aunt, basically told me that I needed to stop making that effort and sending her money and supporting her and thinking that it was going to, you know, create a good relationship because her addiction was too strong and that they were basically using the money I was sending to feed it. And so she said, you need to stop sending that money and you need to let that go. You've done as much as you can. And so I listened to my aunt because she was my mom for a year. My mom actually left me with her when I was 2 and told her sister she would be back and didn't come back for a year to get me. And so she's like my mom too. And so I really listened to her. And so I just let it go. And we, you know, had no connection. And then I heard about my mom's passing away months after it had happened because my aunt got a call from someone that knew my mom. So that's really, you know, so really never really connected in a wholesome way, in a loving way, in a healthy way. But you know, I got the people in my life that I was supposed to get, and I got the mom I was supposed to have in Miss Lane, and I got the, you know, the family and in this eclectic, crazy community of people that were raising me and pouring into me. So I just look back at it, and, you know, I know people that, you know, they had their parents around, and they deal with a lot of heavy stuff because their parents were around. Right. And their challenges because the parents put these fears and expectations and all these things. And so I didn't have that. I had to create my own. And so I didn't have to live up to someone else's expectations. I had to create my own of what I expected of me. And so there was a little bit of a blessing in that in some ways, because I know lots of folks that had their parents and they're kind of jacked and dysfunctional and everything, right? So, you know, you have to, I think you look at, you know, the cards you're dealt, and you determine how you want to, you know, handle that, and, you know, you go from there. So, yeah, I made the effort. Nothing really came of it in the way that I had hoped for, but I think all the things that were supposed to happen happened properly and got the family and people that I was supposed to have.
You know, I was watching the movie The Life of Pi a couple weeks ago. And there's this kid right out in the middle of the ocean, and he lost his family, lost his, you know, everybody. And he's kind of on his own, and he learns to, you know, go through all the things you described, from fear, anxiety, but then he gets to play. And I'd love to go back to that first time. You know, I went back and dug into your archives, but you talk about the first time you kicked the ball. What was that like? Set the setting up for us, and what did you feel when you were on the playground and you have that red kickball for the first time?
There's something, anytime I witness or participate or reflect on movement and what it means to me, I just know that it was my spark. Like, I realized really quickly that when my body was in motion, my mind was free, and I got it. Like, I really understood it on a really, really cellular level, that was my mojo, right? That was my thing. And right. So the first time that I, you know, took a red playground ball, kickball, dodgeball, whatever you call it, and just put my foot into it as hard as I could to send it flying up into the air and just to watch it crest at the top of its height, and then come cascading down and carom against the ground and bounce away and just start to run after that ball. And the effort to chase it down and to run as hard as I could and to finally catch up to it and grab it with this great deal of satisfaction that I chased it down and got it, it was something that was liberating. It was something that was freeing. And you know, all those things, the contact with the ball, the watching it, you know, careen up and skyrocket up into the sky, right? And then to watch it coming down and tracking it as you're running towards it and watch it carry away and to judge the distance and the deflection and everything and change your direction and do all this. I mean, it was just something I was called to be a part of, I think. I just think it was in me to move. And I didn't know that it was going to be part of my saving grace, right? I didn't know that it was going to propel me to do other things, but I got it. Like, I got that it was magical for me. I got it. And so I wanted more of that, right? And so maybe in my own way, I, you know, found my drug of choice, if you will, right? I found the thing that I wanted to, you know, dedicate my time and attention to, and having no idea it was going to open up other doors to things that I would equally love and want to pursue. But yeah, I mean, it was like, have you ever seen that video of that little, of the child that tastes sugar for the first time? Have you seen that video? That was what it was like for me. Like, oh my God, what is this? What crazy, what, I want more of that. That was kind of, I think, how I felt, and I still feel that way. I mean, movement is so important to me. I mean, and I've been perpetual motion my whole life. I can't remember a day that I haven't found some way, even against doctor's orders, right, that I'd find a way to do something that felt athletic or physical, right, or about motion. I just can't even think of a day that I wasn't that way. Even, I mean, like I said, even when I was ill or something, I still do something because I knew that it would get me right, that it would give me my balance back. It was about my homeostasis, as they say, right? My physiological balance, that's what it provides for me.
Yeah. I think there's going to be a lot of parents listening here, understanding that their kids are similar. Maybe they just love to play. or maybe they're trying to expose them to so many practices, so many clubs, teams where they're almost getting burnt out. To me, one of my favorite stories about you was when a teacher wrote a note home to your grandmother, and it was, you know, these teachers give reports on kids, and it was, the note read, "Well, maybe Kevin should think about something other than sports." And for you, did you know that note came home at the time, and what was your reaction? And tell us your grandmother's reaction, because her response is classic.
Oh, no, yeah. No, so I grew up in an era, I don't know, they might have thought it would be child abuse now and stuff, but they used to pin notes on you with a safety pin when you got in trouble, and you'd have to carry it like the scarlet letter, man, on you to the house, right? And so everybody knew if you had a note pinned on you, that's not good news, right? So at elementary school, they would pin notes to you to make sure, and they'd also check to see if there were extra holes in it, like that you unpinned it and read it ahead of time. So it could only have, right, like two sets of marks, because they had to pin it back to you. You had to bring it back signed by your parent, right? So my teacher pinned that note to me. I had no idea what it said, but I remember her saying, "I'm going to write a note home to your family." And I remember thinking, like, I wonder what I did. And so when my grandmother unpins it and reads it, and she reads it out loud to me, that the teacher wrote, "Please encourage Kevin to think about something other than sports." And my grandmother paused. I can always remember that she paused, and she says, "I think I'd like to write a note back to your teacher." And so she turned it over and wrote a note, and then the next morning folded it up and pinned it on me. She said, "You take this to your teacher." And I remember going back into school, and I was feeling kind of like, you know, like, shoot, I got my back. My mom wrote a note to you, lady. Check this out, right? And I literally came into class. I said, "Hey, I got a note for you, and it's from my mom, right?" And so she takes it off. She goes, "Oh." And I said, "What does it say?" She says, "If that's what he loves, so be it."
Wow.
That was really when I was given permission, right? That's when I was given permission that someone was encouraging me. And I think that's what we all are hoping for, right, is that when we do start to profess something that inspires us or sparks us and you tell it to someone, your hope is that they encourage you and not discourage you. And, yeah, I know that, you know, I had fanciful ideas of what sports was going to do for me or allow me to do. And it was all very, you know, what everybody else thinks. I'm going to be a professional athlete, right? And I'm going to be score the touchdowns or making the baskets or whatever thing. But I had no idea that laser focus around sports, but also the other little things that came into play, really would actually allow me to end up doing lots of things around it that I had never knew were part of sports, that were part of the games, because I was fixated on being the athlete, and yet there was a game within the games. There were lots of things that I could be involved in. I just didn't know. I hadn't been exposed to it until I got older. But, yeah, I think if my grandmother had said, "Well, yeah, you need to stop doing that," can you imagine, like, how soul-crushing that would have been? So she was savvy and wise enough, right? She's savvy and wise enough to say, "Well, if that's what you love, so be it."
Yeah. You've always
Game on, thought, fly a freak flag, right? Fly a freak flag. Go on after that, right? So, yeah.
Well, it's like you've always chased your passion, it seems like. And as you referenced earlier, you didn't have an idyllic, you know, upbringing, right? But it's almost like it freed you to chase what you were leaning into, which leads me to, what were you leaning into when you decided to go to college? Because I'm around a lot of high school kids that are about to make this next transition, and they're like, "What do I do? I have no clue where I lean. What's my curiosity?" And for you, you had this unique upbringing where you're, you know, finally given permission as a kid in this class to go chase it. What took you when you decided to go to St. Joe's?
Well, actually, school and education and the importance of academics and doing well, I learned really early that there's no ball without books, Like, so I understood that really early when I got into middle school / junior high school, that if your grades ain't right, you can't play. And so when I understood that, I wasn't going to let anything get in the way of me participating. There was no way, right? Because I knew how much I needed that fix, right? I needed to be a part of the teams and the community and playing and all of that. So I wasn't going to allow anything to get in the way of that. So, okay, if that's the contract I have to sign, then here we go, right? And I dove into my schoolwork, but I didn't realize at first that I was a strong student and I enjoyed learning. And my connection to Miss Lane, who was my best friend's mom, who she ultimately became my mom, and she was the person who really started to instill in me this ability to see broader than just this one thing I was focused on, sports. And it was Miss Lane who expressed to me the importance of my books, right? And she was the one that first told me that you realize when you get a little older, if you don't have good grades, you can't play. And I remember looking at her like with this, like, you got to be kidding me. Who could do that? Who could be so evil to do that to me, right? And so she goes, that's the rules. And I went, really? Like, I didn't know there was this you had to have grades yet, right? Because I was only in elementary school. And so when I started to understand that, I'm like, oh, so I better really address this. I better really apply energy equally like I do for sports into my books so that you never question, am I allowed to play or not? And that was my attitude. So I had a level of intellect that was untapped. And when I started really pouring into my books, my teacher started noticing that I had a great aptitude for learning. And so they started challenging me, and I took on that challenge just like I would take on the challenge of getting better at a skill in a game. And so that just opened up, you know, all kinds of opportunities to be academically inclined. And Miss Lane was the one that said, well, where do you think about, you know, going to college? And I said, well, I haven't thought about it. Well, let's think about it. So she was really that person that put the academic piece in there for me, and understanding and really valuing it. And so when I first got out of high school, I actually wanted to play basketball. It didn't work out. I had some soccer offers. And then I went to school in Tennessee, at Tennessee Wesleyan first, when I got out of high school. And I went down there and played soccer there. And I played there for 3 years. And then my oldest son was born. And I had a decision to make. It was my junior year. We had really good program. Everybody on our team was from up on the East Coast, New York, New Jersey, Maryland, and Pennsylvania. There was not one Southern kid on our team. It was an NAIA school at the time, and we had made the playoffs every year, and we were poised to go to nationals. Like, we were that good and knew we were that good. And a couple of the players on our team ended up playing in the then NASL, North American Soccer League, before the MLS. So they were that good that they played professionally. And my son was born. And it's my junior year, and I was really distracted because I couldn't figure out how to be a dad, right? Because I didn't have anybody really to model that after. My grandfather, you know, did the best he could, but I didn't really have that model. And I kept thinking, I need to do something, you know, about this. So I left school my junior year and joined the Air Force. So I didn't finish at Tennessee. I joined the Air Force, and then I finished my degree while I was in the Air Force. And then I went to St. Joe's to work, but also got my master's there. So I think my academic love and understanding of the importance goes all the way back to Miss Lane pointing out that there's no ball without books moment. And then I dove into school, but then I realized I like learning. I enjoy it. And so I really love to challenge myself academically, and having no idea that it would lead to, you know, learning languages and being a language translator and in the military, and, you know, getting a bachelor's degree and a master's degree and traveling the world. But that was all started with Miss Lane and this idea of remaining curious and, you know, understanding there's no ball without books. So as basic as that. So when these young student athletes and their parents that listen to your podcast, they need to understand that, right? And the sooner you sign on the dotted line for that agreement and that contract, the better. But it's not going away. It's the only way that you can stay in the game. So why wouldn't you embrace it more than push it away, knowing that it could actually help you later on in life?
Yeah, really interesting. You know, as a jock, as an athlete, you know, it's this freeing place, right? Whether it's a basketball floor or soccer pitch, and you go from that environment to, and I'm going to be stereotypical here, but to the Air Force, which is, at least from the outside, you know, it's not as freeing as, hey, we're just going to go play. Now, anybody who plays sports knows there's a discipline within that art form. But to jump from playing on the pitch, being a baller, having a child, and then going to the regiment of the Air Force, what was that like?
It wasn't difficult because my uncle, so my Aunt Sandy, the one that had me for a year, and her husband, my Uncle Bobby, was in the Air Force. He was in the Air Force, career Air Force guy, right? So the only reason I knew the Air Force was because of him. I didn't know any other branch, right? I would see him in his uniform, and I would, you know, connect that to the Air Force, right? So when I went to join the military, I didn't have any other place I was going to look except the Air Force. So I go in and join the Air Force, and I remember telling my uncle I had joined, and he said something really prophetic. He said, well, I'm going to give you the best advice that I received. And I said, what is that? He said, either you work for the Air Force or the Air Force works for you. Yeah. And I went, oh. He said, so you can choose to take full advantage of it or they're going to take full advantage of you. And so when I went into it, understanding this contract, this agreement, right, that, okay, I'll do what you ask of me and I'll be disciplined, focused, and do all the things needed, but I'm also going to get something out of this. And so that was my attitude, right, when I went in the military, was to find a way to benefit from being in this environment. And in my uncle's words and other people that I met in the military that helped learn, you know, teach me how to be, you know, more of the most people won't remember this show, but MASH, there was a guy on there called Radar. And Radar basically knew how to solve everything, right? He was the hookup guy. He was the connector. He just knew how to get stuff done. That I wanted to be more like Radar, that I knew how to solve problems cleverly, make connections, build a network of people to help advance my ideas or ideas of others. And so that's really what I ended up doing, was being more of that person in there. And I had a ball in the Air Force. Like, I wasn't going to get out. I loved the Air Force, and I was very successful in the Air Force and had nothing but great time and had great friends and thought that I was going to be able to stay in the Air Force because I'd got my undergraduate degree in athletic training and speech communication. So I thought I was going to be an athletic trainer, and I was traveling the world with the Armed Forces Sports Program. So I ended up finding a way, to your point, Yogi, that – this regimented, really, really hierarchical, you do things this way, discipline. I found a way to play ball and be connected to ball again in that place.
Of course.
And then I thought, I'm going to get stationed at the Air Force Academy and be an athletic trainer on their staff, right? And I'm going to finish out my career there. That was my plan.
Wow.
And it got derailed by, just like my teacher in grade school, another hater, right? The commander said, no, I'm not going to let you do that. And I'm like, why? I want to sign up. I'll sign up for 10 more years right now. No, I'm not going to let you do that. Because if I let you, then I have to let this person or this person, and I'm not letting anything. Your job is more important than your joy.
Wow.
And I'm
wow.
like, okay, you know what? I'm writing my congressman. So I wrote my congressman. Right. And if you do a congressional inquiry in the military, they have to answer you within 72 hours, I think, your congressman. So the congressman from Pennsylvania had to contact me back. But when you do that, you can imagine, Yogi, you open a can of worms, dude. It's not a good thing, because basically your commander is going to find out that you done called him out. And I did. And I get called to his office. So you did a congressional inquiry. I said, well, sir, I want to stay in. you have someone who's willingly wants to be a part of this great Air Force, the military, but you don't want to bend the rules ever so slightly to allow me to go to a place where I can use my degree, which you paid for, and I'll stay in. Nope, I'm not going to do it. He said, but I will let you get out of the military. I said, really? He says, yeah, but you only get a week to outprocess, which usually takes a month to get all your paperwork done. He said, you have a week to outprocess or you're staying in. So what ends up happening? My connections and network, that radar attitude, it starts getting around what's happened on the base that I'm stationed at, and everybody rallies around me, and I get everything done in a week.
Wow.
And I go to the commander, and Yogi, I'll never forget this. It was like my last act of defiance, right? It was like I gave him a half a peace sign moment, right? So I go in his office, and I'm standing in front of him. He says, well, I guess you got all the paperwork done. I said, yes, sir. He goes, well, this is going to be the biggest mistake you've ever made. I said, sir, why is it a mistake? You paid for my degree. You gave me experience as an athletic trainer, and I'm going out into the world now prepared. I said, you know what, sir? Look for me on TV. That was the last thing I said. I said, look for me on TV, man. Right? When I left, having no idea that it was actually going to play out that way, right, that I would end up being, you know, working for the 76ers and being on TV. But, yeah, so the Air Force was really, really phenomenal for me and wonderful in that it taught me how to network, how to build relationships, how to get people to rally around you in a professional setting, and that, you know, it wasn't just about my goals, right, but how could I get others to connect and believe in and support, but how could they win too? So I realize now, looking back, that I was just recreating Preston Playground, the place I grew up, right, where everybody was invited, everybody was expected to play, everyone needed to participate, and we made sure, right? No one was ever allowed to stand on the sidelines and watch. We always found a way for everybody to play. That was the rule at the playground. Everybody had to be included. It was an inclusive environment. It was never exclusive. And so I just did that when I was in the military, finding a way to get everybody involved and participating and playing.
Wow. So then you go and you're playing, you know, jumping a couple steps, but you're with the Sixers. And you're a trainer in the association. What is that experience like for a kid who grew up on the streets of Philly playing ball, maybe dreaming about playing literally for the Sixers, and now you're in the locker room with the likes of Iverson, Derek Coleman, you know, you're around Pat Croce. I mean, this is an era where the Sixers were actually pretty good at basketball.
Yeah, I know. It's a short window of time, but we were okay.
It was on Prism.
Yeah,
I watched every
like,
game,
yeah.
Man.
Yeah, and it's so interesting. All that, I got out of the military in 1990, and in 5 years, I got to that position. So I went from the high school level to the collegiate level to the professional level in 5 years, which I don't think that can happen now, but it was wonderful circumstances, and things aligned perfectly for that to happen. But I think the biggest thing is I wasn't going for that. That wasn't my aspiration. That wasn't my goal. Everything that I was doing, I was trying to do something to benefit my family, right, to better my family. And so I was raising my sons at this point on my own. I was a single dad. So it was really important for me to find a way to always better our circumstance. And so each of these new roles that I took, it was always about, how do we get better as a family? How do we do better as a family? It wasn't about, oh, man, this is cool. I get to wear this gear now. I'm with this team. Oh, this is wonderful, man. I'm with this group. Or it was never about my titles or my end game or my success. It was about the family success. It was about us as a whole. And so when the Sixer thing happened, and I didn't plan it, but it worked out that I got that position, it opened up a wonderful opportunity for us as a family. And I was there in 95 to 97 with the Sixers. And I was there with Iverson. I would like to tell people he had only a fade haircut, no cornrows, no braids, and only one tattoo, which was the Georgetown Bulldog. That was all he had. when I met his rookie year, and now he's in the Hall of Fame. How about that, right? So I just think that being around that very, and you can appreciate this, Yogi, because you've been around elite level athletes. There's something unique about them, right? They got an extra dose of, right, that what most of us didn't get, right? They're so uniquely gifted. And to watch them move, right? So I appreciate movement, but to watch them move just made me really pause and go, my God, that person, that young man was growing in someone's home and had these gifts and talents, and they got developed, but they had no idea that they could potentially end up here. But they've always been uniquely gifted and talented and special, and they're growing up in someone's house. So when I looked at – I worked for the Eagles for a little bit in the summers, and see these massive men, and you think about them, I would think about them at 6 years old, 7 years old, 8 years old, 9 years old, and they're growing in somebody's house, and I'm like, oh, my God, look at this man, like 6'8", right, 300-plus pounds, and that was growing in somebody's house and eating food, right, and sleeping. I'm like, man, that's crazy, and now look where they're at. And each of them I would always view like they have a unique story. I know they do. And so I, you know, never had any influence or effect on what happened on the court for them, except their health and safety, right, taking care of their injuries. But I was curious about their story. I was curious about how they got to this place. I was curious about what inspired them. I was curious about what were their worries and fears, what keeps them up, right? And we would talk about those things in the athletic training room or on the team bus or in the hotel or at a dinner. And I had a really unique friendship with quite a few of the players because we would just talk about life. And, you know, I always like to say that, you know, meeting Allen Iverson that rookie year and building this relationship with him. And even though I had left to move out here to Portland, Oregon to work with Nike, he made me promise that I would come to the hotel if I was in town every time they came out to Portland. And I did that for several years. And he would always, you know, have a conversation with me before he would get on the team bus to go to the game. And we would always reconnect that way. And one of the, a longstanding member of the Sixers organization said, yeah, Kevin, but one thing that's unique about when he talks with you, he always is the rookie again. He's always that first-year player with you, and he's not that way with anyone else. You guys have a really wonderful connection, and we always just talked about family and how you doing and what's going on and, you know, those kinds of things. And I just thought that that was my contribution to professional athletes in sports was just really, once again, recreating Preston Playground. How can I connect with you? How can we play, right? How can we have a playful exchange and have a connection? And that's what I did when I worked in professional sports and brought that same thing to when I went into the business of sports side. When I worked for Nike, I just did the same thing. Preston Playground really formed a lot of what I believe relationships were about, right, is being really present for someone, being very supportive, just being empathetic. And recognizing that everybody got some stuff with them, right? Everybody's bringing it with them every day. And, you know, how do we make sure that you're at your optimal best, right, to be your best today? And so, yeah, so I really enjoyed my short time there and still have phenomenal relationships with so many people in and throughout the NBA, but also in the NFL. I have lots of friends throughout the NFL that I was an athletic trainer with or interning with. So, yeah, professional sports was a great place for me to understand humanity, that even though you wore a number on your back on the jersey or, you know, you had your name on the back of a jersey or this logo or whatever, that you still were this human being. And it's really interesting that people come to watch you work when you play sports professionally. So it's an unusual dynamic, isn't it, Yogi, right? People don't necessarily come to – you're out in front, so people are watching you work because of your broadcasting and doing all your sports commentary and all that. But most people don't come and watch you work, right? So right. There's an added level of pressure for you to perform and the way people can critique you so quickly, you suck, right? And yell at you and all that, right? I mean, imagine that tension. And yet they perform night after night, game after game. I just had this level of awe and respect for what they could do and the physical gifts they had to be able to perform at this level, and they were so elite. And so I always just had a level of respect for them and just recognized the humanity in the games.
Yeah, I mean, you've always been this subtle nudge, right? And now you'll use the word encourager. Curious about, you know, and I've heard from NBA players like Don McLean, who you worked with in the past, who it was 20 years ago, but he still can remember conversations with you and how you've always been an encourager. And I think people will be very interested in your next phase. All of a sudden, you're killing it, you're growing, you're on this fast track in Philadelphia, and you connect with the people from Nike. And clearly they see the magic that you have in how you connect and how you inspire and how you cultivate ideas. And they bring you to Portland, to Nike's global headquarters, to be a position that has, it's not like they put this up on monster.com and said, hey, who wants to be this position in Nike? So how did that come about? And how did you seek your, or how did you see your role as an encourager within that ecosystem? Cause that place is massive.
Yeah. It was interesting. So the NBA created that opportunity. We were working out a player, Joe Smith, who was playing for University of Maryland. A former Maryland standout, Len Elmore, from back in the day, was his agent. When we were working him out for the draft in 95-96 season, he came along with Joe Smith, and he's doing his workout, and then he sees me. So a thing that I didn't bring up was I was only the third African-American head athletic trainer in the history of the NBA. So there had only been two before me, Kevin Johnson and Keith Jones, who are still both in the NBA working. Kevin Johnson is actually with the Sixers now. Keith Jones, longstanding member of the Houston Rockets. And so Len Elmore sees me and is like, who's this guy, right? Like, he's startled that there's a black guy working for the Sixers, right? But he's not coaching. So who are you? So he starts chatting me up and learning a little bit about me. And unbeknownst to me, he called someone at Nike, Howard White, that evening, who he played basketball with at Maryland, and said, H, you need to meet this guy with the 76ers, Kevin Carroll. I think he should be at Nike. So Len Elmore was the catalyst to start the conversation. And the head coach at the time was John Lucas, another member of that same team with Len Elmore and Howard White. And John Lucas is the head coach. So Howard White calls his former teammate, John Lucas, and says, hey, I'd like to meet this guy you have working with you. Can you tell him to come and participate in this event that Nike's putting on over in Trenton, New Jersey? And so Howard asks Coach Lucas, and Coach Lucas says, hey, Nike wants you to come and do this thing over in Trenton in a couple weekends. Okay, so what am I supposed to do? Just show up. So I show up at this thing, and it's Spike Lee, Ahmad Rashad, Quinn Buckner, Howard White, John Lucas, and myself on stage. And I remember Howard White said, okay, everybody, you get 5 minutes to talk to these young people that are going to be in the park today, and this is Believe to Achieve. So what do you believe in to achieve goals and success? And first person is going up, and he points right at me, is you, Carol. You're the first one that's going to talk. And there's hundreds of kids out there. And it's Ahmad Rashad and Spike Lee and Quinn Buckner, right? These luminaries, right, in sports, right, and entertainment are up on stage, and I'm the first one to go up. So I open by saying something in Serbian to the kids. Dobar dan, kako ste vi, gospodice, ljudi, ja se zovem Kevin Carroll, kako ste vi, right? And basically saying, hello, how's everybody doing? My name is Kevin Carroll. And I remember turning, kind of glancing back, and looking at Spike Lee and Ahmad Rashad, they were looking at me like, what the heck just came out of his mouth? And so I did my 5 minutes and finished up my conversation, and Howard White grabs me and pulls me aside and says, you're going to be at Nike one day. I'm like, man, you crazy. The head athletic trainer for the 76ers. I'm good. He goes, nope, you're going to be at Nike one day. He said, and I'm going to see to it that it happens. He said, and that was his – so he was very intense on getting me to Nike, and Howard introduced me to Peter Ruppe. And Peter Ruppe was running the basketball division at the time for Nike. And so he started connecting with me, sending designers to work with me, other little projects. I'm consulting for Nike, been doing it for almost 2 years at this point. Now it's 1997. And Peter then says, hey, what do you think about coming and working here? And I said, well, what would I do? And he says, well, I'm not sure. And literally that's what he said, I'm not sure, but we want you. So we can figure it out together when you get out here. That was my job offer. And
wow.
So we agreed to that. I decided to leave the Sixers because I really want to find a way to spend time with my sons and not be on the road as much. And so we moved out to Portland, Oregon in 1997. And I started Nike, and literally they don't have a position in mind for me or job title. And they, you know, convinced me that, you know, we'll figure it out together. Just take the first 60 days, find out what people do around here, come back and tell us what you think might work for you or where you think there's a fit. And that's probably where we'll place you. And
wow.
I saw lots of different things happening around the company and strat planning and design, food services, shipping and receiving, oh gosh, and marketing, branding. I just met people because I went around and asked people their story. So how do I know how to connect? Let me see what's your play. What inspires you? Why are you here?
When you say that in a corporate environment.
Yeah,
when you
right.
say that in a corporate environment, are they like, well, this guy's speaking a totally different language?
It was interesting. I think it was more of this, like, it made people pause. And then it made them reflect. Because no one asked you, well, what was your favorite form of play as a child? What got you excited? So you think about in a corporate environment, how powerful a simple question like that could be. Because everybody has a play history, Yogi. Everybody has a play story. We all might not have necessarily played sports, but it could have been Legos, or it could have been science, or it could have been music, or it could have been art, it could have been dance, but that was your play. That's what got you fired up, right? Got you excited about each day. So when people start revealing that, when you really never have asked me, because most of the time they're asked about what's your title, what's your position, what's your responsibilities. Versus, what's your play? What excites you? What gets you inspired? So that conversation was, I think, refreshing for people. Yeah, and I think it probably startled some people and made some people scratch their head a little bit, like, who the hell is this guy, right? Asking me these things. But you know how I am, Yogi, right? I'm really good at disarming people, right? And that's Preston Playground, right? I got to connect with you. I got to find a way. I got to know how to approach you. And as you know, when you're at a park or whatever and sad that we can't go up to playgrounds and see them filled with young people, you know, being active and everything, and we have a lot of safety issues and all of that. But when we were growing up, everybody congregated at the park, right? But you had to have a way of engaging and approaching someone to get invited to play, didn't you? Right. So just like in the animal world, they have what they call the play bow, right, where animals actually bow to each other in a way that says, hey, game on, let's go. It's the same thing with human beings. Right. When you understand how to do a play bow with someone, how to approach them in a non-threatening way, you can start to build rapport with someone, and then that can become anything. And I think that's what I understood in the corporate environment, right, was what's the proper way to approach people? What's my play bow? And that really allowed me to infiltrate that organization in ways that no one ever thought was going to happen. And, you know, I was there for 7 years, and I got to create my own position as basically a creative catalyst in the company, right, a change agent, right, around creativity. But what I was doing once again, Yogi, I was recreating Preston Playground, inviting, welcoming, inclusive environments. That's what I did. It just happened to be around the business of sports and creativity and innovation, but it was about building bridges and connecting people.
Was there a moment that you said, wow, this is working? I mean, I know like in sports sometimes we can look at we could look at the 76ers, right? We could look at where they're playing and say, oh my God, that is the biggest arena. I dream one day to play there. I'd probably be so nervous. But then once you get on the floor, it's the same length as it was that you played back in the day. The hoops are still 10 feet high. So for you, you've been a constant encourager all the way back to when you were a kid and dropped off by your mom and encouraging your brothers to go find an answer, right? Then encouraging your friends to play and then encouraging the Air Force people to, all right, well, if you don't want me to be here, then I'm going to encourage you to let me go. Was there a moment that you said, wow, I know this is Nike and the powerful swoosh, but the simple elements of getting people to ponder their curiosities and what stokes their flame is working no matter how big or small the organization? And if so, what was that moment like?
I had some interesting, collaborations, creative collaborations there that really had a fairly big impact on the company. But maybe the two things that really stand out and made me go, hey, I'm doing something properly and it's benefiting people, were probably when we had the whole company, 3,000 people, play tag for 3 hours. So I got 3,000 people to play tag around the campus and organize that while I was in Berlin. And this was before there was even any of this, like, massive texting and Skyping and FaceTiming and all that. So we were really doing it very analog, kind of back-of-the-day way. And yet we pulled this off and had people running around and laughing and playing, even up to the leadership positions, people were involved. And it was really funny to get feedback from people saying, you know, who's behind this? And someone said, I bet it's that guy, Kevin Carroll. so that was one of my, as they like to say, their Nike moments. And it actually, that turned into a whole advertising campaign that Nike ended up doing around play. And there was actually one of the ads is called Tag, where the whole city is actually playing tag. And so that came from that moment. So that's one. And then another one was when Bill Bowerman passed away. And I rallied what I like to say creative sympathizers, a group of creative sympathizers, to actually put together a tribute from the people, not from the corporation, but from us, those of us who believe that we wouldn't be enjoying the level of success that we had if it wasn't for Bill Bowerman and Phil Knight. And so how do we send a message that's not corporate? And so I rallied a bunch of people and we came up with a way to basically do our own campaign and thanks to the family, and took over the whole place and did a whole guerrilla marketing thing with his quotes. They're called Burma Shave Burma signs, where you go one direction, it has one message. You come the other way, it has another message. So we had images of Bill Bowerman going one way and his quotes as you walked by it spelled out going the other way, and banners. And then I got free waffles for the entire campus before they went to his tribute. And he's, you know, known for the waffle outsole. He used a waffle iron to actually create that rubber outsole for shoes. And so we actually had free waffles. And Bill Bowerman's family found out that there was going to be this waffle feed, and they came early to get a free waffle. And I have pictures of Barbara Bowerman, his wife, licking her fingers of syrup, carrying her waffle before the tribute that we did for her husband, and got a little snippet of what she said. She said, Bill would be so proud of this moment and love this. So those two moments for me made me realize that I could impact in a positive way, but also I could help build community, build relationships, form teams that could really affect and advance ideas. And so that emboldened me even more to do that. But also I think that was what ushered my exit from Nike, was that I wanted to do that for more than just one company, that I wanted to help other people. And so that's when I, you know, decided reluctantly, you know, but it was really with conversations with Peter Ruppe and Phil Knight and a couple other of my mentors there that, you know, I thought maybe it was time for me to leave in 2004, and they agreed. And I remember Phil Knight said to me, he said, I don't like talent to leave here. You'll be only the third person that I tell should leave here at this point in 2004. And he said, but we're proud that we've had you here, and we'll be proud of what you do outside of here.
Wow.
Seal of approval, to get that seal of approval was a big deal to me.
Wow. And only I'm only going to keep you for a couple more minutes, man. But one of my favorite quotes that I steal from you that you told me years ago, I don't even know if you remember it, but you said, if it doesn't scare you, it ain't big enough. And I'm trying to live my life that way.
If your dream doesn't scare you, it's not big enough.
Right. So for you, what was that like? Yeah. You're walking out from a lock cush career job. And this is the guy who said, I want to be at the Air Force for my life. Like, you had this career goal. That didn't happen. Sixers, you probably thought it was career goal. Didn't happen. Nike, mm-hmm. you might have thought, this is it. And now you're like, all right, thanks, guys. But here we go, and now I'm going to go chase my red rubber ball.
Yeah. And at this point, I really believe I was going to bet on me, Yogi. Mm-hmm. I mean, I chose to bet on me. And at this point, I'm remarried now. It'll be 13 years I've been married. So 2003, I got married. And, you know, my wife, who is my encourager, is like my Miss Lane 2.0, right, version is my wife. She's my encourager and my believer, and she challenges me, right, to don't talk about it, be about it. And so that was the opportunity. And so when I went out, I felt emboldened. I felt empowered. I had a level of fear, just enough, right, to keep you really going, but not to paralyze you. Right? And it was enough fear that and angst that I got to get at it, right, every day, right? And so that was just the right amount, but it wasn't this fear I wasn't fearful of, right? And I was really taking a risk, but it was strategic how I was doing it because I had things in place, right? I had a speaker's bureau. I had a book deal. I had some ideas of things that I wanted to do, and I had to learn some things too, but I didn't just leap out there blindly. There was a bit of a strategy behind that, and I like to tell people I'm a risk taker, but I'm strategic the way I take risks, right? So I'm not reckless with the risk taking that I do. And I think that's what's really helped, you know, me to have things in place to understand that you need to have some tools or some resources. And if you go all the way back, like you've been using kind of like that, reflecting back to my childhood, I had a tool at my disposal. I had a phone number, didn't I? Right. So I wasn't reckless. Like, we need to do something. I had a little bit of a plan. We have a phone number. And if you think about it, I've always been calculating in the way that I take risks. But I always have been someone that likes to challenge, be challenged, and also challenge myself. And I think that, you really hit it on a good point that it's been a life of encouraging and finding others to encourage me and to, you know, really be aware of haters, right, naysayers. And I learned this beautiful little phrase from a high school student that, you know, haters are my motivators, right? So when I started to understand really what that was doing, when people would say it wasn't possible, you're not going to be able to do that, bouncing that ball, chasing that dream will get you nowhere, watch me. I'm going to show you. So that's where we're at now, right? I'm still on the quest. I'm still on the chase, Yogi, still doing that. And you know, we don't meet if I don't leave Nike, I don't know if I ever meet you.
Right. Yeah.
I might not have met you.
Right.
Might not have met you, right? We might not have collided. And so, you know, I think that that's part of the magic, right, of making these kinds of decisions and then getting out of the way, being open to things. And looky-looky, right, you get to meet amazing people like you and others that I've met all over the world. And, you know, I count myself fortunate, right, that I have a connection to someone like you who's going to be a game changer, right? And so I, you know, love that I'm one of your encouragers. I love that I am supporting you, but I also love that I challenge you, right? I push you, right? Well, what are you going to do with that idea, Yogi, right? That's always kind of like how we end our conversations. And I love when you always present back to me, this is what's happening. My man, this is what I came up with. I'm like, that's what I'm talking about. That's what's up, Yogi. Keep it going. Keep it moving. So, I'm thrilled that you put together this podcast and, you know, and that you found another platform to share stories. That's your thing. And, I think it's going to be very fruitful, and I think it's probably going to bear fruit in a way you never anticipated.
Yeah. Well, we have so much more to get to. We're going to bring you back on because I want to talk about your book, but I want to finish off with one of my favorite parts on these podcasts. It's early on, but at the end, what I like to do is I want to hit you with a bunch of words, right, or phrases, and then you give me your instant thought, you know, quick, short, what do you feel when you hear the following phrases? Cool?
Yep.
All right, here we go. 86,400.
Maximize the day. That's what you get every day. 86,400 opportunities. That's the seconds in a day.
What makes you feel alive?
Oh, seeing the light of day. That's a good day, as my grandfather would say. If you got to see the light of day, you're alive, then do something with it, right? So I think just seeing the light of day makes me feel alive. And then it's more about what am I going to do with this gift that I got today, the present, right? I've been gifted being present and this present of the day, so what will I do with it?
Vulnerability.
Vulnerability, right? Is that what you said?
Yes.
Fearless, being fearless, right? Being transparent, being willing to show you, you know, your flaws, but also the fact that you're always in beta and you're always improving.
Politics.
It's always going to be political, right? There's always going to be people with opinions and ideas and things that you don't necessarily agree with, but I love the fact that we live in a nation that allows you to have opinions and allows you to express them, and I think that that's the magic of being a citizen of the United States. And you know, our politics are combustible and challenging and all that, but that's the beauty and the messiness all combined into one.
Imagine.
Say that again.
Imagine.
Possibilities. I always believe that we can imagine the possibilities every single day, and that anything is possible, and human potential is boundless and endless.
Inspire.
You need to be inspired. What sparks you? When I think of inspiration or inspire, I always think of a spark or a catalyst. And so we need to have that spark. We need to be inspired. We need to inspire others. So be the embodiment of that and practice what you preach.
Create.
Oh, gosh. Create. I think a big part of that is there are no bad ideas, right? Just bad execution, right? So I just think there's lots of ideas out there, and we need to bring our creative energy and be willing to create and come up with new ideas. And I also think create, I think aha, and a lot of times we think create means this big idea, and I think no, I think sometimes it's just something subtle, just one degree of change or shift of your gaze or perspective that can actually create magic.
And then lastly, limits.
None. You're only limited by your own imagination, your own creative energy, your own want to. Right, and so my grandfather said you can't do anything with a broke want to. If you got a broke want to, you'll be limited. If you don't have a broke want to, passion, purpose, intention, then it's boundless. There are no limits.
I love it. Well, I can't thank you enough. I mean, this is awesome. I mean, we talked for hours, and we're going to get you on again because I want to talk about your book and how you're speaking and inspiring adults to play who may not have a gym anymore per se, but have one in another fashion. So, KC, man, you know how I feel about you. I love you, bro, and thank you for always showing up.
It's all love, Yogi. It's all love, right? So, yeah, we still got to talk about the Alchemist and all that.
Yeah, we got
stuff.
Lots of stuff.
We got lots of stuff to talk about, yeah. So I look forward to our next combo, my man.
All right. Thank you, sir. I really appreciate you. Lots of love, man.
All right. Much love to you too, man. Be well. Peace.
You got it. Peace. So there it is, man. Kevin Carroll. How awesome is that? What a fascinating guy. I mean, really, this guy came into my life I met him on the field of the Seattle Seahawks. We were up there for a meeting, and we walked the field and talked for hours and just told each other our stories. And literally from that point on, the biggest mentor in my life. You know, I've been lucky to have a lot of great ones with parents, and then Coach Carroll when I was in my 20s at SC. But Kevin, no relation to Pete, has really been that guy. So thanks for listening, and I hope that we can find our Preston playground and keep recreating it and recreating it and recreating, because that's clearly what Kevin has done. You can find him on social media. He's great on Twitter, on Facebook. You can check out his blog. All those links will be in the podcast description on yogiroth.com, as well as with Blog Talk Radio. So I'm inspired, man. Honestly, I mean, this guy has a flame that is always charging, always burning, and he really does challenge everything I have. So I'll leave you with this, because I always try to leave with a little bit of a challenge. Find your encouragers. Find them. And I think the way you find them is you be one yourself. And those are people that challenge you, that push you, that can celebrate you, can love you, and can be truth tellers with you. And that has been Ken with me for years now. And to have him on, it's just an absolute blast. So thanks for listening. Lots of love to everybody. And as always, keep living a life without limits, because the only limits we set done by ourselves. Peace.